Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Westminster so early on this frigid morning. Thank you for coming out because we do have a very special seminar. It's our great pleasure to welcome Dr. Leanna Fuller, Associate Professor of Pastoral Care at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And her topic, One Body, Many Parts, Engaging Difference in Congregations, is one I think we can all identify with, and I'm sure we'll all learn very much from Professor Fuller. So please join me in giving her a warm welcome.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you here this morning, and thank you so much for this invitation. I'm delighted to be with you. It's a special joy to see Becky here today, who's one of my former students. One of the great joys of the work that I do is getting to go and teach in congregations and often seeing graduates that have been in my classroom out serving in ministry in various ways. So that's especially fun for me. Before we begin, I've been asked to open us with a word of prayer. So would you please pray with me? Gracious God, for all the gifts of this day, we thank you. For life and health and daily food. We ask God that you would be with those today who do not have what they need. We think especially today of those without shelter in this very cold weather. God, we ask that you would show us the ways that we can be of service to all those we meet. We ask these things in your name. Amen. Great. So this morning we're talking about difference in congregations, engaging difference in congregations. This subject really grows out of a topic that I've been thinking about for a long time. My dissertation research when I was at Vanderbilt was about conflict in congregations. And that interest actually grew out of my experience as a member of a pastoral staff of a church that went through a very intense conflict about 15 years ago or so. And while I was on the pastoral staff serving that congregation and watching our church almost tear itself apart, I thought, surely there has to be a better way of doing conflict than what we're doing right now. Obviously, we don't, as a church, understand how to talk about these differences that feel very important to us. And I think engaging difference is something that all of us are really challenged to do these days. In our families, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, and of course, our churches. And I think it's especially important to talk about how to engage difference in our faith communities, because these are supposed to be spaces where we can be authentically known in all our fullness. So if we can't be fully ourselves at church, maybe there's something not quite right about the way we're doing church, because I, at least for me, theologically speaking, church is a place where we should be able to be known fully. But that can be really difficult to do, to be honest, and even and maybe especially in church. So a lot of times we may feel that we can't bring everything about ourselves into a church space. But if that's the kind of place we're aspiring to be, where we can bring our whole selves into relationship with one another, as siblings in Christ, it's really important, I think, that we learn to engage each other's differences with care and respect. The thing is, I think sometimes when we engage other people's differences, we do it with the aim of changing each other or changing each other's minds. But I'm suggesting that we want to engage difference, not to change each other, but to have greater understanding of one another and strengthen our relationships. So you'll notice that the title of my presentation, One Body, Many Parts, that's of course a reference to 1 Corinthians 12, which has this beautiful metaphor of the church as Christ's body. And as you'll recall from that passage, there's a part where Paul says, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but the parts of the body, in order to be a body, they can't all be the same. The eye can't say to the ear, I don't need you, or the hand can't say to the foot, I don't need you. Each part has its own special function. And if all of the parts of the body, he says, were an eye, in other words, if all the parts were the same, it would no longer be a body. So this is something I think we don't always reflect on. Not only that, like, oh, we're all different, we should all get along, but actually the differences are what make it possible for us to function as a body. And if we didn't have those differences, we would no longer be able to function in the same way or as effectively. So from my point of view, what's most important is not necessarily what our specific differences are, but how we engage and honor those differences that are present in any group that we're a part of, but perhaps especially in a church. We can do that in ways that are life-giving, or we can do it in ways that cause division and pain. So it's kind of our choice about how we engage difference and whether it's going to hurt or heal. And to really take it even beyond our specific congregations, I would also suggest that in order to minister most effectively to the larger communities of which we're a part, so the people that are beyond the walls of this building, we have to cultivate some skills in honoring difference. If we're not able to honor the differences that exist in here, when we already share a lot of the same beliefs and values and commitments, how would we be able to connect with others beyond our church doors who may not share those things? So learning to honor difference and engage with others in meaningful ways across difference are, I think, the key to building strong, lasting relationships, whether that's with family members, friends, our fellow church members, or members of the wider community. The last thing I'll say before I sort of jump into the meat of the material I prepared for today is that the longer I've worked on this topic, the more I've become convinced that honoring differences is not just a social or relational skill, which it certainly is, but I also think it's a spiritual capacity that we can learn to develop. So to put it another way, what I believe about God should have a lot to do with the way that I relate to my fellow church member or my neighbor. In that sense, I think we have a real opportunity in the church to practice honoring the differences among us as a way of embodying our spiritual commitments. If we say we love God, we have to show that we love each other, even across our differences. Otherwise, the truth is not in us. So I like to think of this kind of work as spiritual work, not just relational or social work. I really think it does have a spiritual component. So I'm going to move us into kind of the first piece of what I've prepared for us to think about today. As I've already said, I think in the church, we would do well to start paying more attention to honoring the differences in our midst. And I think we would do well to think of this as one of the most important spiritual disciplines that we can practice together. But this is not easy. I just want to make sure and acknowledge that. In fact, one of the most challenging aspects of relating to other people is engaging difference. We know from the discipline of psychology and other social sciences that human beings generally feel most comfortable when they're with other people who are more or less like them. We know that. That's just part of the way we're wired. Most of us enjoy being with people who share common interests, values, and beliefs. Of course, we know that there are differences between us and our family members, friends, and fellow parishioners, but most of the time, those differences don't feel threatening, so we can cope with that. But sometimes we find ourselves in situations where the differences start to seem more dramatic. So maybe we're interacting with someone who comes from a really different background than we do, and we have very few shared experiences to draw from. Or maybe we're talking with someone we know pretty well, but we suddenly discover a major difference between us about something that feels really important, let's say religion or politics. Or maybe we're just having a really strong disagreement with someone we know very well and that we love very much, but we just can't understand how that person sees something so differently than we do. These are all very normal experiences. They're probably ones that you've had many times in your own life. But the truth is that for most people, these kinds of big, important differences make us feel pretty uncomfortable. In these kinds of situations, we might start to experience fear, anxiety, or defensiveness, and we might start to feel compelled to protect our position by arguing a point or trying to convince the other person they're wrong. The problem is that this kind of argumentation, at least in my experience, rarely helps to draw people together. More often than not, if people are feeling threatened and acting defensively, the conversation becomes unproductive and the relationship could even be damaged when that happens. One thing that's very interesting that I've learned in the course of the years of studying this is that when people feel psychologically or emotionally threatened, which often happens when there's a major disagreement or a major difference they're trying to cope with, the very same chemicals are released in the body as when someone feels physically threatened. So if I'm having a really heated argument with someone, what's happening in my body is the same as if that person were threatening me with a knife or a gun. And we all know what happens when we're physically threatened. We go into a fight or flight mode. And actually the larger part of our brain, the neocortex, starts to shut down and we start to react more out of kind of a visceral place. That is exactly the same thing that happens to the body when we're having heated disagreements or arguments. So that's something that's very helpful to know because I've sometimes seen people acting in ways in the context of conflict. And I think, what in the world is happening? Why are they acting this way? But now that I know that, I can understand, oh, it's because the chemicals in their body are putting them into a fight or flight reaction. So how could we imagine engaging differences with each other in ways that move away from that very visceral, automatic kind of reaction to a way that reflects our spiritual commitments? Or how can we imagine making this a spiritual practice? So one of the most helpful resources that I have found in my work, I've put a copy of the cover on the slide here, is called Dignity, Its Essential Role in Resolving Conflict. And the author is Donna Hicks. Now, I should start by saying that Donna Hicks is not a religious or spiritual writer. She's not a theologian. She is a psychologist by training, and she spent much of her career working in the arena of international conflict resolution. So think South Africa, Northern Ireland, you know, those are the kinds of places she has done her work. But her basic idea in this book is that all conflict, in one way or another, stems from the violation of someone's dignity. That's her big idea, is that when we feel that our human dignity has been wounded in some way, that is when we start to have these very defensive and often unhelpful reactions, all the way from heated arguments to genocide. I mean, this is, you know, the wide spectrum of what can happen, she says, when dignity is wounded. And according to Hicks, the way she talks about dignity, she describes it as a birthright. She says it's something that each one of us has by virtue of being human. It's what gives us worth and value. It's what determines that we are deserving of care and attention. And when that innate sense of worth and value is violated in some way, we experience a very intense feeling of psychological and emotional threat. And we tend to become defensive and even lash out at others. And you can probably think of examples where you've seen this, where everything is maybe just at the level of a minor disagreement. And then someone says something hurtful or somehow things shift and suddenly the tone becomes much more intense. I remember this past summer, a gate agent at the airport made a mistake and boarded the wrong group of people ahead of another group, which to me was not that big of a deal. But to the people in front of me, the couple standing in front of me, it was a big deal, evidently, because when they finally got to board, they basically went up to this gate agent and said, "You really don't know what you're doing," and basically began to verbally abuse him. And I could see the shift in this person from being very apologetic and just saying, "I'm so sorry, I made a mistake," to once this started happening to him, you could see he became extremely angry. And I thought, I'm watching a dignity violation happen right in front of my eyes. But this is what she's talking about in this book, is that when people start to feel that their dignity is assaulted, they're no longer interested in working on a problem or finding a solution or compromising. They're interested in survival and defending themselves. Now, as I've said, Hicks is a psychologist, not a theologian. But I think that her idea of dignity as a fundamental aspect of being human has really deep resonance with how we think about human beings within our Christian tradition, whereas she tends to talk about dignity as our birthright or as a birthright. In the church, we would probably talk about it in terms of being made in the image of God. And so part of what I believe we're called to do in our relationships with all other children of God is to find ways to honor their dignity, even if we experience them as very different from ourselves, or even if we disagree really strongly with what they're saying. So what would it mean to honor another person's dignity? For example, in a conversation where we're hearing someone express views that feel very challenging to our own. So in this book, in order to, the author tries to lay out what dignity is, and then she breaks it down into 10 essential elements of dignity, which I've put up here on this slide. But on your handout, you also on the first page have a list of those 10 essential elements and a little bit of a description about them. So you'll see there's 10 different ones, and some of them overlap a little bit with each other. But you'll see once you read the list, you sort of feel like, well, yeah, you know, this is obvious. But the thing is, we don't always actually honor these things in the ways that we should. So she names things like acceptance of identity. So allowing people to express who they are without judgment or prejudice or bias. Inclusion, helping people feel that they belong. Safety, putting people at ease, both physically and psychologically, so they feel safe from being humiliated. I feel like this is what was happening at the airport. This person was not under physical threat, but someone was trying to make him feel small. They were trying to really humiliate him for making a very honest mistake that any person could make, right? It's almost as if there was no margin for being human in that situation. And so they wanted to make sure that he understood that they thought less of him because he made a mistake. Acknowledgement. This is a basic one, giving people your full attention, you know, making sure that they understand that you're present with them. Recognition is about honoring and recognizing someone's contributions, saying thank you, saying I value your work. Just this morning, I got an email from a student in my class I just taught this past fall, thanking me for the course. And I can't tell you how good it made me feel that he took 2 minutes to just write and say, thank you for the class, and I got a lot out of it. It's not a big deal, but it really goes a long way in helping somebody feel that they're seen and their work is honored. Fairness, again, seems very straightforward, treating people justly and fairly. My favorite is probably this one on the sheet, number 7, benefit of the doubt, trying to start with the premise that others have good motives and are acting with integrity. Now, sometimes you may get to a point in a relationship where you see that that is not the case, right? But I have found it very helpful to just try to start with that assumption and then let somebody prove me wrong. But rather than going in and just assuming that this person is trying to take advantage of me or this person is trying to, you know, do something bad. Understanding is about giving people the chance to explain themselves and express their point of view. Independence is really about honoring somebody's agency, letting them make their own choices, and encouraging people to advocate for themselves. And accountability, taking responsibility for your actions. If you violated someone's dignity, apologize and make a commitment to change your behavior. Now, again, when you read these out, it seems like, yeah, this is part of what it is to be a decent human being, right? But the thing is, I think if we stop and think about it for a moment, we can all think of times when we haven't fully lived up to these 10 essential elements of dignity. If you read the whole book, you'll see the second half of the book, she goes from the 10 essential elements of dignity to the 10 temptations to violate dignity. So the things that we tend to do as humans that end up violating somebody else's dignity. So one is, you know, for example, saving face. Sometimes when we feel embarrassed, we do something to sort of try to make someone else look bad because we don't want to admit what we've done wrong or that we've made a mistake or something. So it's things like that. So basically she's saying, these are the ways we protect dignity. That's these 10 that we have right here on the list. And then she presents 10 other ways that we can be tempted to violate someone else's dignity. But she's really strongly encouraging us through that whole book to think carefully about these in every interaction we have. The thing is, I think it may be true that sometimes we do worse with these with people we know well, because we know that they will still love us even when we mess up, right? So sometimes with strangers, we're very careful to be polite and to protect their feelings. But sometimes with people we love and know well, we don't always, you know, we're not always on our best behavior, so to speak. We're not always thinking about these things. And I have found in my experience that in churches, sometimes this happens because people think, well, this is my church family. I'm accepted here. And so people will have to love me no matter what. And while that may be true, I do not think it's true that when we love someone, that means we just accept any old kind of behavior. Those of us who have, you know, raise children or been part of raising children know that that's not how you show you love a child, is just to let them do whatever they want. Usually you make your expectations clear and then you ask them to be accountable to those expectations, right? And that's, I think, what we would also want to expect of each other as adults. But that's just not always the way it goes for us in the church, unfortunately. So I would wonder from you all, and I know that if anybody wants to say anything, we need to get the microphone, but looking at this list, is there any particular one of these elements that stands out to you that feels especially important? Becky?
Under understanding, give mm-hmm. people the chance to explain and express their points of view. I think the next sentence is really key. Actively listen in order to understand them. And I think sometimes we actively listen in order to make our point.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And we're not really listening to what they're saying.
Yes, that's such an important point. We're actually going to spend part of the rest of our time in a few minutes talking about listening. So that's a great segue. But I often tell my students in the Intro to Pastoral Care course, there's a term called reloading. And what that means is when you're listening, not for the purpose of understanding, when you're listening so that you can formulate your own response. And that is not the same thing as listening for understanding. So thank you for making that point, Becky. Yes, sir.
Just the term dignity, it strikes me. When you think about it, say some really bad dude or dudess in the Allegheny County Jail, we wouldn't even think about them, but they are, I mean, God loves them just as much as God loves us, no less.
Yes.
So how do we relate to them? Yes. I mean, let's say somebody's there, not because they're dangerous, but because they can't make bail.
Right.
I was just reading from the Presbyterian Today, a program where this minister was talking about how they collected money and they went to the jail and bailed somebody out. And this woman had been praying the Psalms about set me free, claiming God's whatever favor. And so when they presented her with the money to get out, she was able to be free. But they wouldn't do that unless they saw her as somebody with dignity.
Yes.
Somebody, dignity meaning that God loves them just as much as me.
Yes. And in the book, Hicks is very careful to distinguish the way she, you know, uses the language, maybe a little different than what we would use, but she distinguishes between dignity and respect. And she says, dignity is that thing that makes us human that can never be taken away. Now, we may not respect someone's choices. We may not agree with what they've done or think it's right, but we can still see that aspect of human dignity. A really great film that illustrates this is Dead Man Walking. It's a bit dated now, but and it's somewhat fictionalized, but it's based on a true story. And it's based about on a real person named Sister Helen Prejean, who visited prisoners on death row. And there's a really moving scene near the end of the movie where she is basically helping the inmate that she's been visiting understand that he is beloved by God, that he has done a very terrible thing, which he does admit to, but that he is still beloved by God and that she's not going to leave him alone, you know, in his last hours. So I think that's kind of what you're describing, you know, seeing this person as someone who is a child of God, regardless of what they may have done. That's great. Thank you. Anyone else?
Esther. On benefit of the doubt, I interact with a lot of people who either make mistakes in things that they publish or who follow up on things that are published that have mistakes in them. And one of the key principles that the people I admire adhere to in pointing out mistakes is to start with the benefit of the doubt, because people who make mistakes generally are not intending to commit fraud. They're just making a mistake. And you can't resolve anything if you assume that they're trying to do something bad.
Right. That's right. Yes. And if you've ever interacted with someone who kind of goes around assuming everyone is, you know, trying to take advantage or do something wrong, you can see how difficult it can be to have a positive relationship with that person, because you don't ever get a chance to show that your intentions are good because already they're assuming something about you. Thank you. So we've kind of covered now this idea of dignity and the 10 essential elements. We've unpacked those a little bit. I think it's worth digging a little deeper now to think more concretely about how we might cultivate this outlook as a spiritual practice. And Becky's already given us a great segue in thinking about listening. So you might have noticed that two of the 10 essential elements specifically name listening as a core practice. So as Becky pointed out, one of them was number 8, understanding, but the other one is number 4, acknowledgement, giving people your full attention by listening, hearing, validating, and responding to them. Of course, as a pastoral care professor, I happen to think listening is the most important skill one can develop, not just as a pastor, but as a human being. But I also really think listening is at the heart of caring and honoring another person's dignity in a lot of different ways. The problem is that most of us don't listen as well as we think we do. We may think that listening simply means being quiet while someone else is talking. I mean, that is an important part of it, of course. But as I'm sure you know, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago, it's possible to be quiet, but to also have all sorts of other things going on in your head. If you're mentally, you know, making your shopping list or thinking about what you're going to have for dinner, or even thinking about what you're going to say in response to who you're listening to, you're not really listening. You're not being as fully present as you could be. We've probably all had the experience of trying to share something with somebody that was important to us and realizing that the person we were talking to wasn't really listening. That feels bad. It feels hurtful. And that's because when we're not acknowledged, as our list would put it, when we're not fully understood, our dignity does get wounded. Now, maybe it doesn't feel as bad of a wound as some other kinds of things may be, but it still is a wound. So another framework that I found really helpful in terms of thinking about listening comes from a book called Redeeming Conflict. It's not the best picture. It's the best one I could find on the internet. This is written by Anne Garrido. And she talks about levels of listening. And this is actually page 2 on your handout. And I'm going to move it to the next slide too. Okay, so you can kind of see that it's sort of like a stair-step framework here. And at the bottom, sort of on the bottom left corner, you see casual listening or sporadic listening in the midst of other distractions. So this is when you're making dinner and you're trying to do 2 or 3 things at once and you're on the phone with somebody and you're saying, and you're not really listening. You're trying to, but you're distracted. Defensive listening is another one near the bottom here, which is listening for what is wrong or illogical, what the other is saying. So that's another form of what we were talking about earlier of listening with the purpose of thinking what you're going to say in response. Also not the most helpful form of listening usually. Now, a level up from that is listening for logic. And I find this an interesting idea. listening to figure out why what the other is saying makes sense to them. Not whether it makes sense to me, but why does it make sense to them? So you can see there's a real shift between defensive listening and listening for logic, that the shift is from what am I going to say in response, or what is wrong with what this person's saying, to, okay, let me try to understand what this person's saying. Then we have listening for emotion, listening for the feelings underneath what the other is saying. And sometimes these are much more subtle, because people don't always say, I'm feeling really angry and XYZ. Sometimes they just say a bunch of stuff and you can tell they're angry, but they don't necessarily say it. So listening for emotion takes some skill and it takes some patience, because if somebody is angry, it can be very easy to go back down to defensive listening, right? To feel like, well, I'm being assaulted here. I need to defend myself. And it takes a lot of patience and kind of willingness to stick with it, to listen for the emotion. Now, I should just say a caveat. You know, if somebody is yelling at you or verbally abusing you, I'm not saying you should just take it. But if you can tell that someone is upset or angry and they're not taking it out on you, but they're just expressing it, it could be an opportunity to try to understand what is happening and how could I understand more about what's going on with them. And then sort of this top level, which the author of this book sort of presents as the goal of listening, if we can get to it, is what she calls empathic or Pentecost listening. Listen to grasp the meaning this has for the other. So it's not just why does it make sense to them or what are they feeling, but, you know, what does this mean in the larger scheme of things for this person? And she wouldn't use the word dignity necessarily. That's not really her language. But I think what she's really saying is this top level of empathic listening is the level of listening that would most fully honor another's dignity, because it is truly trying to listen, understand, and grasp what the meaning is for this other person. Now, she does make a distinction in her book between what she calls empathic listening and sympathetic listening. Sympathetic listening, she says, is when we say, oh, yes, you were absolutely right to feel the way you did. I'd feel the same way you did too, which is sort of like trying to, you know, form a connection with somebody, which there's nothing wrong with it. But she makes a distinction between that and empathic listening, whereas with empathic listening, we may or may not agree with what the person is saying, but we can try to understand what they're saying, whether or not we would feel that way ourselves or whether or not we would take the same position. It's allowing a little bit more distance between us and the person speaking so as to honor their individuality. Yes, I think we have a comment or a question here. Where sympathetic listening is sort of like trying to say, oh yes, you're absolutely right, which is a way of kind of, you know, making us feel good about the connection between us. Yes, sir.
I think something about our conversations, There are two terms that are difficult to nail down, truth and fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be talking to somebody who has a very strong opinion about something based on the facts as they see them.
Right.
And I have different facts. And neither of us is in a position to determine what the facts are, because the circumstances we're discussing are so complex and beyond our control and beyond our participation. So we have alternative facts. And we can listen and hear, quote, facts, which we totally disagree with. But then we have our facts, and we're not absolutely certain that our facts are truth.
Right.
How do we deal with this?
That's a really good question. And if I knew the answer to it, I could make a lot of money, probably, because I could sell it, because we need that today. I actually think you're pointing to something really important, which is, I think, you know, there may have been a time, we could argue whether or not this is true, but there may have been a time when there was more agreement on what facts are, what is the body of facts we're dealing with. Now we're, as you're saying, we're dealing with a situation where people have all different sorts of sources of information, some of which we know are very inaccurate, but we also know that trying to present more information, whether or not it is actually more factual, does nothing to convince somebody of our argument. In fact, it makes it worse usually. There are plenty of studies that show when you present information to somebody to try to show them that what they're saying is not accurate, it usually entrenches their position.
All right, so what do we do when the other person is expressing very strong opinions based upon the facts that they could assume to be true, and we do not accept those facts, but we'll listen and listen and listen and listen, and it gets very stressful for us to listen to someone who assumes certain things to be true, which we believe are not true.
Right.
So at what point do we say, well, we don't agree with that?
Yeah, I think there's always an opportunity to say, like, we simply disagree. However, I also wonder if the way forward in some of these conversations, and it may, of course, depend on the context, who the person is, you know, what stake do we have in maintaining the relationship and that sort of thing. But it may depend on some of these higher levels of listening, trying to listen for feeling and meaning, as opposed to what, you know, defensive listening is where we get into a lot with the difference in facts, what's wrong or illogical. It may actually be true that the person is giving information that's false. I mean, we actually do still have ways of determining whether things are false or true, but that actually doesn't usually help in the conversation. So maybe in those situations, it would be better to try to get out what is the concern that is driving this perspective? What is the meaning this has? What is this person afraid of? What are they worried about? And how is that influencing their feeling about something? And we could ask the same questions of ourselves. What are our own concerns that make us invested in a particular position? And that helps us maybe come away a little bit from our conviction that we're right. But the thing is, we might actually be right about some of the facts, but that actually doesn't help us in the relationship or the conversation. That's the problem, is that we're not actually going to convince each other through debate. Yes, can we agree to disagree and still respect one another? I think that is, in some ways, might be the goal in some of these conversations. Absolutely. And could we find a way to disagree without wounding each other's dignity? That might be another goal. Could we find a way to have conversation knowing we're not going to come to the same place, but without actually harming each other in the process? That's where I think we're struggling right now. Becky, you had something to say.
Something I learned from Dr. Fuller in seminary was to, as part of the conversation back and forth, maybe saying back to that person what they're saying. Okay, so like, you're saying you like so-and-so because of this and this and this, and they're going on and on and on, and stopping and saying, okay, this is what I'm hearing you say. And you're saying that you like this person because of this and this and this, and maybe sometimes it coming out of somebody else's mouth, they might step back and say, "Is that what I said?" You know, or
yeah. Again, a perfect segue, because what we're going to talk about now is the skill of paraphrasing. I know, she's a plant. Yeah. I mean, one thing that's interesting before we kind of jump into the paraphrasing piece, but I think this is really important, we're going to spend some time on that, is it an interesting question to sit with for each of us is, what in our own lives allows us to move from that defensive listening posture to listening for logic? What has to happen in a conversation where we're willing to move out of that? And it could simply be we feel respected, or we feel like the other person cares. I think we have another comment or question here. Thank you.
To me, the linchpin in your hierarchy here is listening for logic.
Mm-hmm.
If you can understand the logic, it seems to me you've dipped into listening for emotion and, mm-hmm. you know, empathic. But if you can really understand the logic, you've touched on mm-hmm. the two above it.
Right. And I actually think that step from defensive to listening for logic is the hardest. So it's like, what allows us to move from that defensive posture to being willing to understand? I know I have personally been in conversations where I've thought to myself, I don't want to understand this. I'm deeply offended by what this person's saying, and I don't really want to understand it. But if there's a way we could move from wanting to defend to wanting to understand, we might get there.
But I think that means you're deeply invested in your view.
Of course.
Don't care to give it up.
Which, I mean, all of us are, right? If we didn't feel strongly about our positions, we probably wouldn't hold them. Yes, comment over here.
This describes so much the situation between my brother-in-law and me.
Yes.
And I can't get from the defensive listening to the logic anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just gave up.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that I might move up is if I care more about my sister than I care about what my brother-in-law thinks about me.
Mm.
And I don't know yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really important point that, you know, at different points in our lives, we just may or may not have the bandwidth to go into these places of listening for logic with particular people. That's a choice that's very personal that only we can make. And it could be that in different circumstances, you know, there might be another person who could listen for logic with that individual. But there may come a time where you or, you know, any of us might feel like, okay, because of other reasons, other relationships, other things that I care about, I need to work harder on this movement from defensive listening to listening for logic. Yes, Ted.
So that makes me think that in some situations, I find I have to just skip over the listening for logic to listening for emotion, because the logic is not so important as the emotion that underlies what this person is telling me. And one maxim that I kind of cling to is, whatever you're feeling is what you're feeling.
Right.
I'm not entitled to say, you know what? You shouldn't be feeling that. Even if I don't like what they're feeling, even if, you know, they're expressing a great deal of hate or something like that I find repugnant, that's what they're feeling. Okay. And then there might be reasons behind that that they can't even articulate. But the other thing that I wanted to say was, there's a world of difference between between my reaction to people who might say, well, we're just going to have to agree to disagree about this.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody who says, well, I understand what you're saying. I have a different feeling about it, but we can disagree.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a world of difference. And the difference is someone who is condescending and saying,
yeah,
we're going to disagree because you're wrong.
Right. There's a subtext there sometimes to those words. Exactly. So now we've pondered and talked together about these basic concepts of dignity and the importance of listening. I want to kind of pick up on what Becky was already alluding to and think about, how do we do that? How do we listen better to each other? So we're going to be looking at pages 3 and 4 of the handout now. On that third page, you see at the top, it says listening for understanding. And this is exactly what Becky was describing earlier. It's kind of the most basic listening skill that there is. Many of us probably already do this, whether or not you knew that's what you were doing, you may already be doing this. But it's a very basic technique, and it allows us to try to get a better understanding of what someone else is saying. The thing about listening is that it is a skill. It means we can get better at it. It is true that some people probably are maybe naturally more gifted at listening than others. But even if you're a person who struggles to listen well, you can improve with practice, right? So this is just a way of practicing a skill in conversation. And so all you do is very, very basic. You see there the basic steps are listed under the heading. Paraphrase, check for accuracy, understand the significance, and validate feelings. So you see step one, the speaker initiates the conversation. I wanted to talk with you about blank is now a good time. They say what they have to say. And then you mirror or paraphrase. let me see if I understood you, or if I heard you accurately, you said, or so what I hear you saying is. Now, when I teach students in the basic pastoral care course, many of them resist this at first because they say, this feels so artificial. What I hear you saying is, you know, and so I always say to them, yes, it feels artificial. You don't have to use these specific words. You can find phrases that match your own style as a listener. But it's actually quite remarkable what happens when you do this with regularity. People respond to it. They often are surprised that you've taken the time to really understand what they're saying, especially if it's something where you're having a disagreement, right? So all you do is just try to say back to the person in your own words what you heard them say. And then you add the check for accuracy. Did I get that right? Or have I understood you? Did I hear you accurately? Now, one of two things can happen. If the speaker says yes, then you can invite them to continue by saying, tell me more about that, or, you know, asking them a question or something. If they say no, or almost, you can invite them to try again. Oh, I've missed something. Help me understand what you were saying about XYZ. So that then you kind of get to the point where you can accurately say back to the person what you heard, and they agree that that's what they said. Now, this is a really important skill in life, but even in academics, like I tell students, like it's really important when you write to be able to accurately depict the viewpoint of another person before you argue with it, right? You need to show me that you understand it first. So in the same way, what we're doing here is, even if you want to offer a point of disagreement, I believe the other person is going to be a lot more likely to hear what you're saying if they believe that you've understood them. So basically, you just go back and forth, paraphrasing, checking for accuracy, until the speaker feels like, yeah, you've got it. Then you see on step five there on the sheet, you move to try to understand the significance. Check your understanding of why and how this is important to them. Help me understand more about what that means to you. Or it sounds like you're feeling this because of that. Is that right? And then validate. It makes sense to me why you're feeling blank. Now you see this is a slightly different order than the levels of listening. This is just a different way of approaching it. And of course, this sheet is something that I give to students in a pastoral care class. So they're thinking about this as they're trying to give care to somebody. In your own situations, that may or may not be what you're doing. You know, so you may be just talking with a family member or a friend about something that you disagree about, or maybe you don't, maybe you're just trying to understand. But at any rate, I think that this process of trying to paraphrase and check for accuracy, understand significance, understand feeling, it actually creates a certain kind of space in a conversation where people can feel like, okay, we can disagree, but I know that you have really tried to understand. You're not just sitting there waiting to debate me or rebut my argument. You know, you're actually kind of coming with me. If you want to think of a metaphor, it's like taking a step toward the person in the conversation rather than sort of pulling back, which is what we often do when we have a disagreement. We sort of, it's like a rubber band, you know, we kind of pull back as far as we can. But this is a way of actually moving toward the rubber band between us gets more slack in it. So it doesn't feel so tense. That's one way I like to think about it. So again, it doesn't necessarily mean we agree with or endorse or condone anything the other person's saying, but it's just a way of trying to understand. And if you have a good relationship with this person, you can even talk about like, let's try this strategy and like each do it for each other and see what happens, you know, see if we understand each other better at the end of the day. The second piece I have there on the page four on the back of the handout, these are just some general tips for listening at a deeper level. So page three was really that specific skill of paraphrasing. Page four is just some general guidelines that you can keep in mind. So when you're engaged in an emotional conversation or where you have strong opinions, thinking about listening as being as important, if not more, as presenting your own ideas and opinions can be helpful. So again, if we go in with the idea that my job is not to change the other person's mind necessarily, but it's just to listen and try to understand as best I can, it may change our posture a bit and help us move from that defensive listening to the other levels. Listening with your eyes for body language as much as with your ears is really important, because sometimes, as I was saying before about listening for feeling, sometimes people don't even realize they're feeling something. And sometimes they may have a disconnection between what they're thinking about and the way that's coming out in their posture or their body language. And sometimes simply inviting somebody to reflect on that can be helpful. When I was in youth ministry, I had a student who was, you know, had some challenges socially and things like that. And he was invited to do the devotion one night on mission trip. And he got up to do the devotion, and he just, everything about his body language, his expression was just, he was like, he was furious. He was so angry. And so he's sort of giving this devotion. Everybody in the room is thinking like, this is weird. He's trying to invite us to this moment, devotional reflection. And he seems just so angry. So afterward, I approached him and I said, you know, what's happening? Because you really seemed like you were angry a few minutes ago. And he was very surprised. And he said, oh, I was. I didn't think I was feeling that way. But as we talked, you know, he'd come from seeing his father, his parents were divorced, and he always had a lot of strong feelings after he'd been on a visit with him. And it was almost like he was not even conscious of the feelings that were going through him. Of course, he was a teenager, so he wasn't as practiced with noticing that. But that was a really good conversation in our relationship pastorally, because I was able to say, here's what I noticed about your body language. Is there anything you want to talk about? And he didn't even know that he wanted to talk about it. But once he was invited, he said, oh yeah, I had this really hard weekend. And I guess maybe that was in my mind and I didn't realize it. So that's something that can help us sometimes when we just make an observation gently, right? We don't want to be too pushy with that. And that's similar to number three, listen for what's not being said as well as what's being said. Is there a comment here?
I'm trying to go through my mind to see if there's anything in scripture that says that I must love someone even if we are at the point of war. And I, since you're not going to be here in a few minutes, is there something in scripture that does that? That I
love your enemies. Huh. Jesus says that, which I could interpret to mean,
there you go.
You know, at the point of war, sure. That's what I would go to probably. But of course, loving, I think, is different than liking or agreeing with, right? So loving to me is about that honoring of dignity. That's not quite the same as saying, I want to be this person's best friend, or I agree with what they're doing. So listening for feelings as well as facts or information, summarizing to make sure interpretation is accurate. Number six is the one I always emphasize, as I mentioned before, reloading. Rehearsing what you will say. Try not to do that and instead focus and listen carefully on what the individual is saying. Notice if you're making assumptions, right? So that goes back to our benefit of the doubt thing. It's just in your mind, just ask yourself, am I giving this person the benefit of the doubt as I'm listening? And then this number eight is trying to resist that temptation to cross-examine people. So it is very important to try to understand, right? To paraphrase, but asking a whole barrage of questions, although to us it may be an attempt to understand, to the other person it may feel intrusive. I had a student who called it the Barbara Walters syndrome, you know, just like asking question after question. Again, our intention may be good, but I actually find it more effective usually to say things like, help me understand what you mean by blank, or could you say more about blank, rather than, you know, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And what do you mean by that? Also, just as an aside, why questions tend to be experienced by people as putting them on the defensive. Why'd you do that? You know, even though our intention may not be that, I have noticed that in my own experience, and I try to avoid why questions when I can, especially if it's like, why did you make a certain choice? Sometimes that can be experienced as a judgment. So I try to find other ways to ask. I think I'm going to stop right there. I will just say we have a couple minutes left for questions, which I can happily take. But before we go into that, I just want to say that, you know, this week we've really been focusing on the idea of dignity, trying to honor people's dignity, listening well. Next week, we're going to talk more about, okay, all of these skills we've learned today might even help us avoid conflict or keep it less intense if we do these things well. Next week, we're going to be talking more about, okay, what if the conflict is already there? It's already started. What are some things we can do to try to engage that constructively, as opposed to letting it become something that's very divisive? So that's kind of the connection between this week and next week. Any final comments or questions anybody would like to share in the time we have left?
I have one question.
Yeah, thanks, Ed.
I think I heard you say something about respect versus dignity. And on one hand, I understand the idea that you can respect someone's dignity while not respecting their behavior.
Right.
But respecting their dignity comes down to the same thing to me as respecting the person, even if you don't respect the actions or choices that they made.
Right. Yeah. So the difference between dignity and respect, this is something that Donna Hicks really does in her book. Not everybody would necessarily agree with her distinction between those things, but she's really trying to say, you know, honoring somebody's dignity is just recognizing that they are a human being that has worth and value. She tries to draw a distinction with respect, which she orients more toward like someone's choices or their way of interacting. So we don't necessarily have to respect that. We don't have to agree with their choices or the way they treat people, or even think what they're doing is okay or right, to also understand that they are a human being with worth and value. So the way she puts it is respect has to be earned. So I think what she's trying to say is like, let's say I have somebody in my life who really is not a nice person and doesn't treat people well, doesn't honor other people's dignity, doesn't treat people with respect. I don't have to respect that way of doing things, but I can still honor that individual's dignity and think that person has worth and value as a human without necessarily. But I mean, it's a hard distinction, right? Because when we see somebody mistreating others, we don't really feel like honoring their dignity very much because they're wounding other people's dignity, right? So I see the distinction she's making, and I also know that it's very hard, you know, in the moment to actually make that distinction in our heads. But that's why I think the dead man walking example is a good one, because here's someone who's done something really, really heinous, and yet somebody can still see that he has value and worth and is willing to reflect that back to him. So thank you. Any other questions? Well, I think we're just about out of time. So thank you very much for your attention and your participation today. Thank you.